This is No Direction's PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage. PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage was made possible thanks to the support of the Roll for Combat podcast, as well as the dedication of our team of volunteers. Due to possibly questionable language, this panel is rated Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Hi, everybody. It's time for us to get started with horror and RPGs. My name is Linda Zayas-Palmer. I am a developer at Paizo. I've been there for about 3 and a bit years now, and I've worked primarily with the Pathfinder Society scenarios.
And I am Landon Winkler. I am from outside of Paizo. I do a little bit of freelancing, but most of my horror stuff is for Shadows Over Vothic, which I wrote on the little card here. I apologize. It's completely illegible. Many years of horror GMing, so hopefully with our powers combined, we can give you some cool tips and tricks. So I guess, just jumping in, getting started, we've kind of arranged things in the sense of what order you end up doing them in the game. So we're starting with before your campaign even really starts, assuming you're doing a more long-running horror experience. And first big thing ends up coming up in session zero, sort of like even before that sometimes, while you're planning of what sort of content you actually want to have in the game. And we're sort of lucky in that the last few years have been a huge horror renaissance, movies, games. So you might have two players that are coming in, one of whom is like, oh yeah, I want to play horror, I want to play, you know, Saw, right? Another player's coming in, oh yeah, I want to play horror, I want to play Get Out. And both of those, totally legitimate horror, but the other player might be extremely uncomfortable with the content involved for totally legitimate, totally okay reasons.
I believe that was in one of the other Olympic rooms.
Yeah.
No problem.
You really want to make sure that you are creating an environment for people to enjoy the horror experience that you're giving them. They want it to be scary, they want it to, you know, sort of get outside of their comfort zone, but you don't want to be starting to throw just totally uncomfortable stuff at them. And I personally always handle that in session zero, just sort of like, what is everyone comfortable with? What is everyone uncomfortable with? What does everyone really want to see, right? End up just sort of going down the list of stuff that maybe I have planned for the game. Like if I'm running an adventure path, I might look through and be like, okay, like book three of this has some, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre stuff going on. Is everyone cool with that? A lot of things that do cause problems are hopefully pretty obvious, like sexual violence is usually just sort of, off the table for a lot of groups, off the table in a lot of products. To put a little finer point on it, this is often phrased as, if you have women in your group, there's a very good chance that one of them has experienced sexual violence, just statistically speaking. There's a second half of that, which is, if you have men in your group, there is still actually a pretty good chance they've experienced sexual violence, and a much lower chance that they will tell you about it. So it's, even if you have a group that is not expressing their, you know, discomfort with this, it's a really dangerous territory that personally I would suggest just not going, but that's your decision, really, as a GM and as a group. Another one that is often off the table but you can usually judge a little better is child endangerment. Generally doesn't show up in published modules very much because there are a lot of people, we call them parents, who generally aren't very into that sort of thing. But if you're playing with, like, your high school group, your college group, whatever, maybe you don't have anybody who cares about that. But definitely if you're working on anything published, really, really think very hard before you start throwing stuff like that in there. But there's some other things that you might not immediately think about. Some of the more mid-tier stuff. We ran into a problem recently with harming animals. So it's very normal in a game to have, like, oh yeah, like, these, this enemy has riding dog that attacks you. Just like normal part of a druid stat block, right? Well, like, you're asking your players, hey, kill this dog. A lot of players aren't okay with that, like, if you actually stop and think about it. So asking that can be very helpful. Torture is a huge one and gets in a lot of how deep you go into it, right? If you've got, like, example at the front, if you've got the player who's expecting Saw, they're expecting a very different level of description of these things than a, like, oh yeah, this guy looks really roughed up, like he's clearly been through some bad stuff. Most people can handle that. Jumping straight into, you know, the graphic description is a very different thing. But also, things like, I mean, suicide and self-harm that might remind your players of things that they've either experienced or dealt with friends of theirs, various forms of death even for NPCs, but also getting down into, there's a lot of things that we just don't think about that can really, like, get players, you know, to stand up and leave your game, not as an insult, but just because, like, they're that uncomfortable. The sort of classic example of that is spiders. Like, we've all read Tolkien and the like, or at least, like, watched the Lord of the Rings movies, presumably. And, like, that's actually a huge problem for some people. And hopefully, you know, you can double-check that for them. The one we both sort of realized while we were talking before was the Tooth Fairy monster in Pathfinder. Like, doesn't bother either of us. Mm-hmm. Throw it in your game. And people are like, wait, this little bastard is prying my teeth out with pliers? No.
I've been in a game where someone actually needed to get up and leave the room during a Tooth Fairy encounter and have her character be NPC'd because she was so uncomfortable with the idea of something happening to her character's teeth because she had bad dental experiences in the past. So, I mean, what a lot of this really boils down to is that making sure that you have good communication with your players about what they're comfortable with, what they want to see, and that they the players' comfort and experience comes first.
And that sort of brings us to an interesting point where we're all going to screw up. Like, none of us are perfect. It doesn't matter if we've got, like, the title behind our name. It doesn't matter if we're paid to do this. We're all going to screw up sometimes. And I think...
Yeah. So one thing I wanted to talk about is what happens when you do? What happens when you realize that you've said something, you've done something, you have kind of some kind of theme in the game, and you've made someone uncomfortable? So the first thing to do is to stop doing the thing. Don't do it again. Respect the person's experience. Apologize to them. But also don't, like, make a giant production about it, because if someone's upset about something, they're probably not going to want you to be like, oh my god, I am so sorry, I'm such a terrible human being. How could I have ever upset you? Why? How may I atone for my grave sins? You know, that just creates more of a strange situation. So just try to address it and move on with the game and give them a chance to talk to you later if they want, or to someone else that they can talk to if they're upset about it. But just sort of, you know, pick it up and move on. And in some situations, particularly if you're doing something that's really boundary pushing, you might want to consider having some version of nonverbal signaling. So if someone can be like, meh. So you probably heard of X cards you can put on the table to say, okay, this is not okay. Or maybe like red cards or yellow cards just to kind of show, like, okay, this is coming up against something that is borderline for me, or this is something that we might need to stop. So generally, being open to revising that session zero contract if something else comes up and you're like, okay, yeah, this is not okay for me. So we did want to talk about this first, just because it's very important to make sure that everyone's enjoying the game and that you're all coming to it from the same general perspective. Another general thing with horror games is sort of shifting gears a bit, is emotional tone. So some people, they want to play horror, and they want to play something where, like, everything is grim dark, and like, they are fighting for their lives, and in this game, you win if you're still some semblance of alive at the end, and not everyone is dead, and the entire world isn't destroyed. And in some games, you have more, you can, that are still horror games, you can have more of a heroic feel of it. So that's another good thing to gauge at the beginning. It's like, what do your players want? Do they want to be the heroes that clearly triumph over the horror with some scary horror elements in it? Or do they want to really be like, I am in a terrible world, and if I make it out of this and I can still string a complete sentence together, then that's a success. So that's a good thing to talk to your players about at the beginning. So what emotions do they want to have out of this? Do they want it to be really scary? Do they want it to be, you know, kind of campy, cheesy horror movie horror, where, you know, you've got like the fake masks and the over dramatic acting and that kind of stuff? It's really up to what you guys want to bring forth.
And I think that raises a sort of interesting point, because everybody, you're sitting down for a horror game. Presumably everybody wants to play a horror game. I mean, there, you didn't, you know, promise a completely different thing to people. One of the things that I think is really unique and honestly really cool, like this is the stuff that gets me excited, about tabletop gaming with horror, is that, so we talked a lot at first about the sort of like consent and content and like the things that people might, places where people might not want you to go. People who have those sorts of experiences, those sorts of fears, don't often have the option of going out to the movies and feeling like that's actually a safe experience. Like, you know, if you go to a normal horror film, there's no control, there's no oversight there. Like, you can look at, like, the MPAA warnings, but it's not going to tell you what you really need to know if you have, like, a dental phobia or, you know, have a lot of problems with torture or what have you. And so you can, as a GM and as a group of players, you can really open up this experience to people who wouldn't be able to have it otherwise. And it's such a cool and often, frankly, kind of therapeutic experience to be able to dip into this intense sort of cathartic emotion. It requires some careful handling, some management, some forethought, but like you are really getting a chance to do something very cool for another human being, like above and beyond the fact that you're having this great fun game and everyone's hopefully enjoying themselves.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk a bit about, we were talking about a lot here, like modifying the adventure or like adapting it for your players. So I wanted to talk about a little bit from the organized play perspective, when you have, this is the set adventure and you're running the adventure, what kind of things you can do. Some certain scenarios, there's a few of them out there, have like little content warnings in the beginning that's like, yeah, this scenario has orcs that have runes on them, and this is basically suicide bombers that show up in the scenario. So make sure that if you're running this, that you're aware of that and that your players are going to be comfortable with that. In most other cases, like Landon was mentioning, you know, if you have players who are really afraid of spiders and they're not going to be good with the spider swarm, it's totally cool to be like, you know, this is a, it's like, you know, out of character, yeah, this is spiders, so if you have any mechanics that add to them, whatever. The bugs attack you, or that kind of thing. So, but really, how much do you get into the description of things? You can certainly pull back, as opposed to diving in whenever things get more towards something that someone wouldn't be comfortable with. We do find that this hasn't been that much of a problem that I've heard about, I guess in part because we don't have evil PCs in organized play. So when someone starts like really towing that line with the character, the dude, don't let, that's not cool, is a little easier to pull back. It's just a, you know, it's important, as with everything else, to, you know, keep communication open, to watch people's body language if they're pulling away or distracted from the table. Just like in any other session, to see if everything's going all right there. So another general theme is sort of the theme of, and a different topic, control versus helplessness in horror. Because a lot of the sort of theme in horror is the idea that like, oh, things are out of my control, like something terrible is happening, is the monster going to attack, what am I going to do, and that kind of thing. And at times that can be sort of conflicting with the traditional idea you have in the heroic RPG, where you're the hero who has the control, you have the choices, you're winning. So one thing to keep in mind for that is that at times constricting player choice can be very powerful, as long as they still have choices. And these choices may not be great. It could be a rock and a hard place. Which one are you going to go with? But you need to make sure that the players are still able to drive the narrative, even if their characters are in really bad situations. And if you want to set up a game where there is going to be more restriction, just kind of, you know, talk to your players about that. So another thing is what good characters are for horror games. And what characters might not work as well. So if you want to have a game where fear is a big aspect and someone was like, I'm going to bring a paladin who's immune to fear, then, you know, that might not necessarily be the best fit for your group. Or I was going to run Karen Crown once and I said, okay, nobody who's immune to fear and no lore oracles. Because if the idea is that, you know, there's going to be the unknown and there's going to be the threat of this, then, you know, someone who's just like, well, I rolled a 50 on knowledge, I've totally already solved this mystery, then, you know, that doesn't necessarily work either. So when you're putting together the horror game, sort of thinking about what do you need to be there in terms of the unknown? What do you need to be there in terms of what is threatening? And make sure when you work with your players to make their characters that you're not going to make someone who's just like, and I sailed through all of this. Unless, it, you know, because then that doesn't fit with the entire theme of what you're going for. Let's see. I think that's about it for that point. Do you want to talk about, a little bit more about Pathfinder and Starfinder as horror games?
Yeah, it's an interesting sort of thing. If you go out online, and you'll find, of course, strong, strident opinions on any topic online, but I feel like you'll often get this impression that Pathfinder isn't a horror game. Like, it doesn't have, like, the mechanics that you need to tell a horror story. And I've run other, like, dedicated horror games, you know, Call of Cthulhu and whatever. But honestly, it's not a horror game if you run it exactly like all of your other sessions, obviously. But if you sort of stop for a moment and look at what's actually going on in the game. You know, if you look at, like, what are these monsters that they're fighting? It's not just like, you know, it's puffy Candyland monsters or something. We're talking about the horrors of almost every civilization that's ever existed on the planet. That we have any idea what they were afraid of? That's in the bestiary. Like, it's like, oh, hey, you know, like, crazy monster from the Philippines that, frankly, I cannot pronounce correctly. It's in the bestiary. It's like, oh, and the other one? It's also in the bestiary. And so there's that half, and then just, like, the even combat and things like this, where we, you know, oh, you hit it for 8 points of damage. If you get into, and I won't for the sake of anyone with tender stomachs, but if you get into, you know, sort of, like, the description of what's actually going on in that combat, what these characters are actually experiencing as they go through this, it can be incredibly horrific. And that's really kind of the beauty of a system like Pathfinder, where you can just sort of tilt it, like, not even a lot, like 10 degrees. You tilt this game, and wow, there is some crazy, awful stuff under this hood here. So yeah, it's definitely something that I think is worth we're thinking about, but yeah, more on the description, sort of ambiance.
Yeah. I think I talked a little bit before about choosing characters and a little bit about what didn't make the good character, but certain things that make good characters are, you know, not too paranoid, cautious, but not too paranoid. Like, So rather than like being like, oh, I suppose I must be in a horror world right now, unless that's the kind of fourth wall breaking stuff you want, a character who will just sort of discover what the situation is that's going on. Another thing that is really builds the horror is investment in the world and its characters. If your characters have families and those families come under threat, then that can really be something that drives the action and amps things up if that's what your players are into. But just in general, investment in the world. Do your characters care about this city where everything is completely going downhill and things like that? It's that investment in the character and the world that really can help drive the emotional experience. In general, a good horror character is a character who has something to lose. So You know, horror is not always, is sometimes a good place to move away from the whole, like, oh, my character is a friendless orphan who has decided to become an adventurer, and he's taken up his sword, and now he's going to go slay the monster, to really get into the soul, the emotional aspect of it. Another thing, too, is, like, if you know what kind of horror game you're building, sometimes you'll know a little more about what the characters are good for that or not so good for that. So, like, if you're playing a survival horror game, you're probably going to want to have characters who have survival skills, but not necessarily like, oh, I just cast remove disease. What was that thing about the disease, GM? Okay, I just cast a spell that's gone. So that's also something to keep in mind is that, you know, you might need to tailor things a little bit and sort of guide what kind of characters you want to have in your game so that you can get that experience across. So once you've sort of decided on your game, you figured out what you want to do, you figured out what your characters are, you know, where your players' comfort levels are, that kind of thing. So there, you start to get into setting the scene. So a lot of people for horror games like to use things like scary music, lower the lighting, things like that, because horror can really be, works best when it's immersive. Generally, it's a good idea to ask people to put away the distractions even more so than a usual game, because it's a lot easier to jump back into, oh, wait, it was my turn? Okay, yeah, I swing my sword, than it is to jump back into, like, the experience of being in a horror game. One thing that I really like to do, particularly when running horror, but also in general, if you can, if you can ditch the grid, I like to ditch the grid unless I absolutely have to have it, because then you can take the focus off what's on the table in front of the players and put it on the descriptions of, okay, yeah, instead of I see this mini and it's next to me and it's this monster, you can describe, like, okay, this hulking creature is towering over you with acid dripping from its fangs as it roars and things like that. You can get into that a lot more easily. It can be a lot more immersive than if it's just like, okay, hold on, I'm going to move my pawn six squares, then you're going to move your pawn six squares. When you do that, it does involve a little more like fluidity with the rules. Like, you sometimes just have to be like, all right, well, I don't know exactly, but it seems like you should be able to flank. So yeah, you can flank. Okay, yeah, you can flank. Okay, and you kind of err on the sides of the players when you're doing something like that. But I found that it's worth it to have that little more fluidity in the combat so that you can really focus on exactly what's going on and get the players into it too. You know, and if they're just like, ah, I slashed my sword 5 damage, it's like, okay, but where do you attack it? How do you hit it? What happens? In general, I like to do that when people get critical hits and completely overkill a monster. It's like, all right, how do you kill it? Tell me what happens. That sort of thing. And in horror too, that can certainly be useful. One thing that is easy to fall into is focusing on the visual descriptions. So do you want to talk a little more about what other kinds of descriptions are good to use in horror?
Yeah, this is one of the ones that, like, you go to a writing seminar and they're always like, oh, use all 5 senses. And that does apply to horror as well. It's not always a perfect, you know, question, but sort of like just as a checklist sometimes, go over, like, okay, I'm describing this room. Like, I'm describing what it looks like. I might be describing what it sounds like if the players, you know, made their perception checks. Are you ever describing what it smells like? Do you describe what the air tastes like? Are you describing, like, what things feel like either in combat or, like, in the space that they're in? And there's a really neat trick that you get to play with horror games where... you're drawing on this sort of shared emotional experience, this attachment, all of these things, where you can really push it or pull it back, not even based on, like, just the pure graphicness of the description, but the amount of resonance somebody has with it. So if you can describe something in a way that sounds familiar to your players, or, like, I mean, is familiar, like, it's something that they've heard or smelled or experienced before, they will have a much stronger effect from that. You know, they, depending on where they grew up, you know, they know what the rustling leaves sound like. They know, you know, the grasshoppers or cicadas or, I should say, crickets. Grasshoppers don't make any sound. But they, what those sort of sounds and tastes and smells or like, but on the flip side of that, if you're worried about pushing it too far, you can do the exact opposite, which is, you know, go for more elaborate fantastical descriptions that, like, you know, it, if you can, I mean, you're talking about, like, the, you know, the smell of the acid from the creature's fangs, that's probably not something that the players have any experience with. They don't have any emotional attachment to it, and that's a balancing act as a GM, like how hard you want to be punching them, basically. And if it's getting to be a bit too much, shifting to those more fantastical sort of descriptions can really help you pull that back. It's not always the goal to push them as far as you can. It's the goal to push them as far as they want to be pushed.
One thing that comes up with descriptions in horror, something that I've become a lot more aware of since I've been working on adventures, is that there can be a bit of a tendency to use some unfortunate shorthands, like the idea that if somebody's body has a disability, or if somebody looks different, then like that's the cue that's supposed to be like that they're evil, or that like you should be afraid of them, or something like that. So if somebody has a mental illness, it's like, oh yeah, they're the villain because like they're crazy or whatever. So especially it's good to watch out for that too. Like you were talking a little bit before about like, you know, Lovecraft stuff having the racism in it. So when you're presenting this in the tabletop experience, it's good to be aware of those shorthands and try to find other ways to describe it. Or if you're describing like, you know, a body horror style mutation, that, you know, if it comes in the form of burrowing tentacles sprouting from underneath their skin, then, you know, that doesn't have anything to do with a real world disability, but it can be pretty horrifying nonetheless.
I feel like there's some really good stuff there, just in with like body shape too. Like you'll have sort of like the, you know, corpulent noble who is clearly a bad guy because he's fat, and it's like, come on. Or the, you know, cultist who is inevitably like emaciated and stuff, which is sort of like, and it's fine to, I mean, have villains of all body shapes, but like it's also like, if that's just a cheap way of getting like, ah yes, this is the person I'm supposed to be afraid of, that's, you're not going to get the shock out of it. It's just sort of a shorthand, which is kind of, I don't want to say lazy, but it's kind of lazy. I guess that sort of speaks to a bigger sort of pacing concern, where when you're trying to like build tension, you don't want it diffused by something like that, just because like your natural shorthand, which... Fair warning, I mean, we all have. Like, this is not like, oh, you people are bad because, like, you do this. Like, we all have described people in ways that are both very obvious and very insensitive before. Like, that's just humanity. But as far as, like, the general pacing, it's an interesting question, because so much of our horror experience is rooted in movies now. And there's a very, very specific way that you go through, depending on the subgenre, but like sort of the, you know, are we going to have like the jump scare that releases some tension here, or is it going to be like this long, drawn out slog of, you know, slowly building tension, more of a gothic thing. But in gaming, it actually pays off a lot more to start thinking more of like, I mean, depending on how serious your game is, I mean, any, like, from Scooby-Doo to, like, Buffy the Vampire Slayer to X-Files to, like, Walking Dead, whatever, of how do we maintain this tension for, like, the 2 to 4 hours that we have with the player, or 8 hours if you've got way longer games than I do, and then get them coming back next time. So things like thinking more or less about, like, how do I stretch this movie plot over, like, 6 sessions, and like, okay, how do I make this session basically a good episode in a horror TV show? How do I get a good cliffhanger out of it, so they're like, oh god, what's gonna happen next? And like, that's the little burr in the back of their head, so that when they come back next week, the tension jumps back up just that little bit to help you get started again, so you can structure that a little better.
For For pacing reasons, I'm just going to skip over these next 2 points and Good. Jump down to the one right above the next header. So one other description you can have in addition to sight and sound and smell is emotion. Because if you just say, like, your character's scared, that's a lot different from talking about you know, them having all these intrusive thoughts about the idea of their chest pounding, everything else completely fading into the background. They're not, their legs are trembling. They're thinking that, you know, all they can imagine is this monster coming for them and they have to run. It's a lot different from just being like, you have a fear effect, okay, you're panic, go, that kind of thing. And so it can be really cool to get into that. Or, you know, the idea that when a character is acutely afraid of something, that, like, they may feel that, like, they're always going to be afraid of that thing. That thing is omnipresent. That thing is completely looming. So I know for me as a person who has a lot of experience with having anxiety myself, that I can bring forward those descriptions of, like, what is that actually like when fear just completely wipes everything else in your mind away. And I have found, I've actually found running horror games to be kind of very interesting and therapeutic. And also, nightmares are a really cool source of custom horror monsters, if you have nightmares, just saying. and your emotional attachment to those creatures as you put them out there is just, like, can really freak people out. They're like, where the hell did this come from? my brain, last week, you're welcome. So moving on to a bit of another thing, knowledge on the unknown. So the unknown, the unfamiliar is really important in horror. And so secrets are also very important. So when you have really experienced players and they're playing Pathfinder and other game systems that they're very familiar with, no matter what, they're going to be familiar with. If you show the picture of the monster, you give the standard bestiary description, they're going to be like, all right, yeah, it's a skeleton, okay, yeah, use your bludgeoning damage, blah, 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 blah. And so that kind of thing, once you get that metagaming knowledge, even if the players are trying hard to push that down, they're still going to be having to spend mental energy to suppress their real-world knowledge as opposed to getting into the game. So a few things that you can do for that. First of all, slightly modify those descriptions so they don't just sound like those monsters from the bestiary. Maybe they have something else going on with them. And that way, you know, your players aren't going to know exactly what they're up against. You can also, you know, swap out a few abilities just here and there, like pull an ability from another monster into this monster. And then they think it's a skeleton, but then, like, you know, suddenly it has some horrifying roar, and then the skeletons don't have a horrifying roar. Where did that even come from? It doesn't have a throat. I don't know what's going on. And then you can make it a lot less familiar to them. And another thing, too, is pulling information behind the screen for perception, sense motive, knowledge checks, so they don't know that they know. You can maybe give them something misleading. If you have, say, a conspiracy theorist character and they're rolling their knowledge checks, then maybe not everything they know is completely accurate. Maybe there's accurate facts, but then there's also other things mixed in there that are completely misleading. And other things like a saving throw against a disease or a poison, if they don't know whether or not they made it, they're just like, well, there was a disease. I don't know. Am I sick? Am I showing symptoms? Like, you don't know. You don't know what's going on. Maybe you're okay. Maybe you're not. Another way to kind of use the metagaming impulses, I don't want to say against the players, but I use them to make the game more interesting. Players tend to assume that if something is described, then it's important. So if you over-describe something that's just completely mundane, like, you know, there's a puddle of water on the floor, it gently bubbles, that kind of thing. The players are like, what's going on with that puddle of water? Or, like, you know, there's a painting and it has, you know, its eyes, it has rather intense eyes. I can't tell you how many arrows I get players to waste on statues by putting minis out for statues on the map when I am putting out maps. That statue is towering menacingly over you. Oh my gosh, the statue, when is it going to attack? So the topiaries are out to get you, whatever. So if you kind of describe that sense, and also, like, you know, the players might roll a perception or sense motive check and they might see a suspicious rustling in the leaves or other things like that, because when you're scared, your mind can play little tricks on you like that. So that can really help to set the scene there. Bringing those sorts of things up.
Is on a similar note to the sort of perception stuff, anytime there's, like, with mysteries, there's, like, divination and knowledge, like, are sort of considered the enemy almost. Like, oh, they're going to, you know, break my mystery plotline. In horror, they're this beautiful gift from the players to the GM. It's like, oh, please scare me. It's like, I want to, you know, make a knowledge check about, like, this monster that we're facing. Well, let me tell you about all of the people that it's killed and how. And that may be very useful information, like they may learn the damage types, they may even learn some of its resistances from the information you're giving them, but at the same time, like, they are explicitly asking you to give, to get that sort of open channel for, you know, rumors, for, my favorite is Detect Psychic Significance, if you haven't used that spell from Occult Adventures, it's a beautiful thing. But yeah, they're, even stuff like Detect Magic, like, they're really just... They're literally asking for information. Just get a little horror in there too. Get it right back into their planning brain. Mm-hmm.
So we talked a little bit before about what does winning look like in a horror game compared to a more typical game. And one idea that we didn't really go over was the idea of the threat level of the monster. Because a lot of times when you have monsters in a more traditional Pathfinder game. The monster is there so that it's a speed bump on your road to something else. You'll kill it and you'll get its stuff and you'll move on. A common theme that you might want to have in a horror game is a monster that is an overarching threat that is too powerful for you, that is lurking. And the idea that you might have an adventure that's structured around not, you know, we save the town and we save the day and whatever. It's, you know, there's this one monster and that's what we have. This is the thing that's lurking in the shadows. This is the thing that's jumping out. We don't know where it is. We don't know where it's coming next. But if we don't deal with this, then there's going to be a serious problem. And so winning in that case is, you know, saving the town or getting everyone out. And it's not like, I have this large hoard of treasure and the accolades of the king and that kind of thing. But winning really does depend upon the genre that you're playing in.
Yeah, it gets interestingly back into some of the Lovecraft stuff that we were talking about. And, I mean, he's a huge touch point to horror gaming in particular, but horror in general. But it's sort of like the definition of winning in a Lovecraft story is very different than the definition of winning in, like, a gothic horror story. I mean, in Dracula, spoiler alert, like, Dracula kind of just dies at the end. Like, it's not really very exciting or, like, nail-biting. He just sort of dies, like most of the villains do in our games. But in a Lovecraft story, you have a very different definition of that. And it can be very important to, going back to the Session Zero stuff, to talk to your players about that. Like, what are the expectations? What are the victory conditions that we're looking for?
So we have about 15 or so minutes left, so we'd like to open up the floor for people to ask questions. I saw your hand go up first.
So actually, specifically because of Pathfinder Society, I saw last week before that Strange Eons was finally allowed for Pathfinder Society. It's honestly one of my favorite adventures.
Yes.
Any recommendations? Because my players want to start playing Strange Eons Society.
Yes.
How? Any recommendations for that? Because one of the things that I've done when I brought it before, I love the madness mechanics. Absolutely love the madness mechanics out of horror adventures. Any recommendations on running that in Society?
So you could run it in campaign mode, and then you can just run it however you want and still get them credit for their characters. So that would probably be the most flexible way to do it. Because if you're running sort of in the just society mode, then you'll also be cutting out a fair number of encounters because that mode is more designed to run it in more compact slots and stuff like that. So, yeah. Because, yeah, you can customize anything you want at that point and still get them the character sheets.
Yeah, definitely campaign mode would be a great bit for that.
You were next?
So I wanted to ask about something you were talking about earlier, keeping the players in the dark, controlling their access to information as a means of heightening the tension, which I totally get. At the same time, horror plots, they are based on some sort of procedural investigative mystery type. Mm-hmm. Where if your players miss the critical clue at the murder scene, you know, this sort of pooches your whole plot because your players don't know where to go. And you mentioned running Call of Cthulhu. Have you ever looked at Trail of Cthulhu?
Yeah, Trail is good. Gumshoe, I mean, in general, is a very good investigative system.
So they basically have rules that say if it is a plot critical clue and they make an investigative skill roll,
they get
auto succeed.
Yeah.
And I think this is a great
absolutely.
Yeah. And that's a really cool solution. Another one I've seen is the rule of three for mysteries, that if you need them to get to a particular conclusion, make sure there's at least three ways for them to get to that conclusion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you have one of those ways be that kind of way, that they're still going to get through to it. This is something that we do in Pathfinder Society scenarios a lot, because, you know, ultimately you need to get people to the end. So the idea of, yes, you do find your way, but it's not as good. You had to get help from this suspicious character and now you have some sort of debt. Or you had to fight this extra monster and now, you know, you have this injury from that or something like that. So the general idea of, like, you move forward, but it's not as good as if you had succeeded your check.
There's a secondary thing there where we have this impulse, I feel like, as GMs, to sort of hoard our secrets, and that it can be really actually antithetical to horror, not just mysteries, but horror in general, where, like, you want them to know, like, I mean, if you think of any, like, slasher film, like, there are always the cutaways for, like, mm-hmm. this is how the slasher horribly dealt with this person. You want that information to get to the player. That's almost the point.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, yeah, just push that stuff out, like, as hard as your players are willing to, you know, deal with, and let them see that. You don't want to hide your scary stuff. That totally defeats the point.
Mm-hmm. And it also comes back to, like, the differences in the genres that you're running. Right? What do you want to show them? Or are you doing something that's more focused on the direct mystery? Or are you doing something that's more focused on the shock? That sort of thing. But the control of information, how you reveal it, how you hide it, is very important in horror. You had a question in the front.
So, the session zero consent to content conversation, the difficulty I find in that, if I'm not playing with somebody whose phobias and triggers I already know,
mm-hmm.
is, hi, I'm Ray, what are you most afraid of? Like, I don't really want to share that with you,
mm-hmm.
but I'm here to scare you.
Yeah.
I'm not sure where to approach that, but I had to share, breaking the taboo, I had to share an anecdote from my best scary encounter. The party had run off and they were escaping the way they came, and one PC by himself, make a perception check. Make a sneak check. Make another perception check. And then he moved forward 5 feet. And in just a series of perception and sneak checks, eventually he escapes into the light and, oh my god. That was, you know, the Umber Hulk had wandered off. He wasn't actually in the threat anymore, but there was no way to know that without sneaking quietly down the corridor.
That's cool. So, in answer to the first question that you asked there, I mean, it's one of those things where people might not feel comfortable. First of all, make sure they have a way to tell it to you privately, not in front of all the other players. And second of all, that's one of the importances of ongoing communication and being willing to revise that session zero contract if something does come up, to step back, to apologize, and then to move forward.
Another thing you might want to consider is there are technical tools you can use, things like SurveyMonkey, that can be actually just anonymized. Like, it's like, oh, here are, like, the 10 questions, you know, mark from, like, you know, 1 to 5 how okay you are with this, with 5 being yeah, and 1 being never. And you can just get the raw data, like, with none of the personal identifying information on it. Technology can be great for stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And that?
So let's say you're in the middle of your horror game and you realize you pushed things a little bit too far. You've got your PCs, hit points are down pretty low, and then you know that they're not going to be able to recover by themselves to move forward. Things are starting to look like they're going to fall apart. How do you move forward with the game without making it look like you just screwed up and you're giving the players free stuff because of that?
I like help with a catch. So if there's somebody who will help the PCs, but there's going to be a price down the line, I mean, sometimes like you can't necessarily completely hide that like the encounter was too hard. So there is always the option too of just being honest with your players about that if you realize like, okay, you know, I goofed. But if it's just completely transparent, but in other cases, yeah, if you can have someone come in and like, well, you know, I could help you, but you're going to owe me a favor later. Like, who is this person? Or like some kind of figure, a figure comes in and, you know, they're fighting some terrifying creature and something comes in and like swoops up and grabs its body and flies off. And that's like, what the hell was that thing? What else do we have to deal with here? And that can be a way to sort of make it feel like it's part of the plan all along. I mean, some amount of GMing is always like, oh yeah, I totally meant to do that, guys.
Isn't that old GMing?
Yeah, you know, so sometimes they do what you think they're going to do. Sometimes.
another thing that you can do when the PCs are really up against the ropes, and this applies to all games, it can be particularly awful in horror games, is having them be captured. I mean, it's an oldie but goodie, but I mean, there's a lot of horror to be had in the helplessness and isolation of captivity. If your group is into that, that can go some very dark places very quickly, so be careful.
Mm-hmm.
But there's that can actually be a gift to the game if played correctly.
Yeah. Yes.
How do you feel about fudging dice rolls?
I
mean, especially in the context of horror, but you know, as to your point earlier about making an encounter too difficult, because there have been times where I had my party fighting a bunch of the drowned sailor,
drowner,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
and it's like, you know, they got great axes and one of them crit, mm-hmm. and then I rolled the damage. I'm like, that would outright kill him. So then I'm just like, I just pretend I'm struggling with the math, and I'm like, you take this much damage, it's 3 points off from just outright killing. Just wondering what your views on that are.
So, personally, I don't like to fudge dice rolls. When it comes to like really new players, and it's or like it's a kid or something like that, I might. But I prefer to fudge tactics. Because there's always the smartest way to fight, and there's always the let me bash on the tank for a long period of time who has their shield up and has really high AC.
Oh, yeah,
let me oh okay, that's a problem then. Yeah. Like, you know, let me waste some time going into a villainous monologue about how clearly I've defeated you, or you know, let me go over here and try some really contemptuous strategy because I don't want to waste my spells on these fools. Or that sort of thing. So that's generally what I prefer to do. But I know everyone has sort of a different comfort level with fudging, and that's also something that's always hard to discuss, especially when there's a microphone sitting right there and your players are listening and they're like, "You what?"
There's a flip side of that where it depends. I guess not really even a flip side, but it depends a lot on what kind of horror you're going for. If you're doing like a hard survival horror, like mm-hmm. zombie apocalypse type thing or something like that, I think that fudging is very wrong in that instance, just because that's sort of really very much the tone you're going for is like, oh yeah, like bad luck, you just super died, and that's very in that genre. But in other cases, it may be less appropriate. So I guess be mindful of what kind of story you're telling.
Yeah, it's just because I was playing in a Call of the Blue game,
mm.
and it felt more like a grind than a horror. And
yeah.
by the end. Like, it was horror on your own express, so I don't know if you know how that mm-hmm. one goes. But by the end, none of the original party members had survived.
It's fact, hard.
My character was fresh on that final session. I had to roll him that session, so I was like, I had no, like in character, I had no incentive to stick around. Like, oh, there's all this horrific stuff going on. Let me just run in the opposite direction.
So one thing I've done too is in my Keymaker game, I really wanted that persistent PCs. So I put in a thing where the first time that you die, you would die, you don't die, you just have some really bad injury. So the character had a shoulder injury that gave him a relatively significant penalty to melee attacks. He was kind of a melee caster hybrid druid, so he's like, I'm not going in melee anymore. I'm totally doing my bird form, and I'm going to stand in the back. So ways to sort of be like, you live, but there's some downsides. You're going to need to go find that. In that case, it was, you know, eventually he found a regenerate spell, And then he didn't have big melee penalties anymore, but by that point, like, he still was like, no, I'm a casting druid. In the back?
How do you handle capturing players, right? Like, sometimes, let's say session zero, they're like, well, we don't want to get rid of them. Right? You decide, like, you need to get captured. You have, like, 3 ways to fail. You have the illusion of choice when you get over them.
I very rarely do that other than actually as, like, part of session zero. Like, if the campaign starts with everybody in, like, cages or whatever, that's one thing. So that would be actually how I would start the game. Rather than something I'd throw in later. I'm not sure if you have any actual advice.
That's probably about what I would say, too. Because if it comes about as a consequence of them being defeated in combat, then that's kind of a natural, like, okay, yeah, you were all knocked unconscious, but they stabilized you, and then they took you to the prison or whatever. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a hard road to hoe.
So we just got a signal that we're out of time here, but I'll be outside for a little while longer if anyone has any questions. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you for joining us for another PaizoCon 2018 seminar recording. Special thanks to the KDCon team, including Justin Sluder, Ryan Hiller, Stephen Glicker, and the entire Roll for Combat crew. No Direction's PaizoCon coverage would not be possible without their tireless effort. To find this and other great Pathfinder podcasts, visit nodirectionpodcast.com.